Good morning again. Please be seated. All right, we're here for oral argument in our case number CR25-0106, State v. Yohannes. These proceedings are being video and audio recorded and live streamed, so we ask counsel to please identify yourself and your clients at the beginning of your argument. Each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant's counsel is responsible for watching the clock to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if desired. Please keep in mind that we've read the briefs and have conferenced the case this morning. And with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. Seth Apfel on behalf of Appellant Edmund Yohannes. We are seeking remand to the trial court for a new trial. I'm going to address the cell phone issue first, then I'm going to address the double jeopardy issue, and time permitting, I'll touch on a couple of the other issues. So starting with the cell phone issue, I think initially it should be noted that the state effectively conceded that the search itself was illegal. So I'm not going to address the legality of the search unless the court has questions related to that. Instead, I'm going to address what the state argued, which is good faith and harmlessness. Now, on the good faith issue, in order to have good faith, there has to be law that the state was relying on.
Does there have to be binding appellate case law, or is it broader than
that?
Well,
for Fourth Amendment purposes, absolutely yes.
Right.
The state is relying on a broader reading of 3925 to suggest that there doesn't have to be binding appellate law, but in this case, there does. And frankly, in this case, there's no law at all that the state could have relied upon. And in fact, the law said specifically the opposite, that this search was not permitted. Both 3918 has been in place for decades. Miguel has been in place for more than 20 years. So you had at least 20 years of law, established law, that said that the state was not allowed to conduct the search in the manner that it did. They needed to get a new warrant. And if that was not enough, you have Riley. Riley is unequivocal. You need a warrant in order to search a cell phone. At the time they searched the cell phone and did the extraction, the warrant was void. So they did not have the right to do that. You can't rely in good faith on law that does not exist. And that's precisely what the state is attempting to do in this situation. Now, if you go to the harmlessness issue, interestingly enough, which kind of goes into the second issue that I'm going to be addressing, the court itself already determined that there was no harmlessness here. Because at the trial level, the trial court said, hey, the introduction of this material from the cell phone, specifically the kick remnants, was so harmful that by not disclosing it, a mistrial was necessary. So I don't see how you can get to harmlessness unless you are arguing, at least the state, unless the state is arguing, that the trial court abused its discretion in so finding that. But then again,
isn't there a difference between something being harmful for purposes of disclosure and whether it's harmful or what impact it might have when it comes in vis-a-vis all the other evidence that the jury is presented with?
Well, of course, it's not the exact same analysis,
right.
But the point that I think is illustrated here is that the trial court itself, which was very, very familiar with the facts of this case, because there was obviously very protracted litigation. The case was going on for a long time. There were a ton of motions litigated before the trial court. The trial court itself.
Right, but at the time the trial court made the statements you're talking about, there had been opening arguments and one witness presented, right?
Correct.
So at that point, the court didn't know the rest of the evidence that was going to come in at trial.
No, the court actually had a great deal of familiarity with what the evidence was going to be that would be presented at trial because of the number of evidentiary hearings, pretrial arguments. There had been scores of motions that had been litigated by that point because this was a case that involved a substantial amount, just looking at the record and the number of record
but the,
items.
The court's concern at that point wasn't, at least I didn't read the court to be saying the concern was the substance as much as the ambush of it, the disclosure violation, the failure to alert the defense that the detective's testimony would change.
Well, the court was concerned with both because the court said, hey, throughout this entire process, the defense prepared based on a theory of the case that there was nothing in the cell phone. And then all of a sudden, here's this new information presented that there is something in the cell phone after all. And absent this evidence from the cell phone, there is nothing directly tying Mr. Yohannes to the cell phone. So this was absolutely critical evidence. And keep in mind, the state has to prove that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I mean, didn't the You said there's nothing tying him. Did the officer say that's this? I pulled a cell phone out.
Cell phone. So
his vehicle?
Yeah, correct. The correct way of expressing that would have been there was nothing tying him to the communications with Detective Russo.
I see.
Yes. And so.
Other than he was there at the place at the time. He matched the description, at least half of his face did. He had an Iron Man stuffed animal and a panda stuffed animal.
Wasn't there evidence that the officer sent test messages to Mr. Johannes?
The test messages were not responded to. So the test
message. He heard a ding.
Yes,
when
and
sent them.
But later on.
Contemporaneously.
Yes, but later on that was revealed to not have actually come through to this particular cell phone. So we don't know where it actually went. That particular testimony was discredited. He may have heard a ding, but it certainly wasn't from the test messages. It would have been from something else. Could have been, who knows, maybe from his own cell phone. But the point being, it was not from these test messages. Now,
so I guess practically speaking, how is it not harmless in light of the evidence that I'm just talking about him being there at the time, at the place? He lived at Gilbert in Chandler. He has the stuffed animals.
The vehicle matched.
The vehicle matched.
Well, Mr. Johannes is not arguing that there was no evidence that he was the person that was communicating with Mr. Russo. The question here isn't whether or not there's evidence that supports a possible conviction. The question here is whether or not, absent the evidence tying him directly to those communications, any reasonable jury could have found him not guilty. And if you subtract that evidence, that's a pretty powerful piece of evidence. It was powerful enough, as I said, that the trial court itself looked at it and said, you know what? The ambush with this evidence is serious enough that I have to declare a mistrial. So the trial court itself, in a position to judge the overall body of evidence, decided that it was significant enough that it necessitated a mistrial. So because of that, I don't think that the state can meet its burden to show harmlessness, because this was evidence that tied him directly to the communications themselves, where they had no other such evidence.
I thought the kick remnants and the grinder evidence found on the phone didn't link to the Chandler Top account. I thought it just, the gist of it was these, at some point he may have used these apps, but there it didn't go into, it didn't reveal the specific communications or anything like that.
Well, you have the two separate ones. You have the grinder evidence, which is also a huge problem for the other act issue, because there's really no probative value whatsoever of the number of communications that he had in Grindr. I think that was really just shock and awe in order to disgust the jury. But setting that aside, you had the kick remnants. If you don't have kick on the phone at all, then they can't prove that Mr. Johannes was the person communicating with him, because he could just say, it wasn't on my phone. How could it have been me? It's a case of mistaken identity. I'm not the only black man of this size that happens to live in this particular area. And so he had a defense that he could have mounted in the absence of the kick remnant evidence.
I guess this is kind of a counterfactual, but they wouldn't have known what, I mean, under your arguments, they should not have accessed this phone. So they wouldn't have known either way whether there was kick on that cell phone or not, right?
Well, that's correct.
Okay.
And what they should have done, especially in when you look at Riley. Riley places the cell phone right on par with the house, which is one of the reasons why this court could certainly apply Alt to give an even higher standard of privacy in a cell phone.
I mean, I suppose your client's counsel would have stood up at trial and said the state has presented no evidence that he had kick on his phone.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct. And so, you know, looking at Riley and the level of protection that a cell phone garners, all the state had to do if they wanted to look in the cell phone was get a new warrant. You know, the question here is, would probable cause still have existed? It may have. You know, the state talks a lot about the static nature of a cell phone, and they could have gotten into it at any time. But this was a phone that was kept unsecured at the detective's desk. People could have accessed it. And on top of that, there are things that auto-delete after 30 days. You know, I think we're all familiar with emails that we delete after 30 days. We can't get them anymore. So if Mr. Johannes had deleted something, the remnants may have been gone after 30 days. So we can't say with certainty that it was absolutely static. So all they had to do was get a new warrant. If they believed they had probable cause, they should have done that. They didn't. They knew the law required it because this is established law. So there is a deterrence purpose for saying, no, this should have been out. And based on those reasons, the cell phone search should not have been allowed. The court erred for allowing it, and a new trial is warranted just based on that. Now turning to the mistrial issue. The court made very specific findings here. The court found bad faith. This is not one of those cases like Dietrich and some of the other cases that I discussed in my briefing, where there was just sort of an isolated incident, a small whoops, and that was it. The court found that the prosecutor was very deliberate, intended to ambush.
So I think based on what I read the state to be arguing and what you are right now saying, but in the interest of time, I'm going to suggest that we move. As I understand it, we're arguing only about like half of 1 point within the pool analysis.
Great.
So like 2 point B, I guess.
The second step, correct.
Yeah. So whether the prosecutor acted with indifference to a significant danger of mistrial or reversal.
Correct.
So maybe if you want to focus there, we were at the very beginning of the trial, so it couldn't have been said to be going particularly well or particularly poorly for either side. Talk to me about what we see in some of the cases about this type of indifference. How do we get there?
Well, let's sort of take it in two pieces. Before I hit that, let me back up for a second and say, think about it from the prosecutor's perspective. You've asked the detective to try to find this additional evidence. You now realize that you have it after all, but it's too late to get it in. Well, why don't I just try to get it in anyway, even though I know the rules present it? In the worst case scenario, I get a mistrial, and then I can try to introduce it in the second trial. So there is a deliberate nature to this misconduct, as the trial court found.
What rule, I guess, what rule did the prosecutor violate?
Well, 15.1 required this as disclosure. This was required disclosure without question in Rule 15.1.
Because the detective had been deposed and his testimony was going to be different at trial?
Well, he was changing his testimony.
Because your client had this same, my understanding is your client had this same information. And so your client could have done the same, or your client's expert could have done the same thing that the prosecutor and then the detective did, which is type kick into the search bar and press enter and see what happens.
Conceivably, the
expert. So I
don't
view it so much. I don't know. It's hard for me to see it as a disclosure issue when your client had the same data and could have done the same thing. So is it disclosure, or is the problem the changing testimony without disclosing that?
Well, the second portion is the bigger issue here, because the state's witnesses told my client's attorneys, hey, there's nothing on here. So why would my clients then look through tens of thousands of pages of documents if they're being told by the state's witnesses, there's nothing on here? They're entitled to rely on the veracity of an officer of the court and a detective during an interview.
Am I right, though, that your client could have just put kick into the search bar and pressed enter?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely. That's certainly within the realm of possibility. What you're talking about, again, looking through a significant amount of documents, because you can't just push in kick. You have to review every single potential result. So that's very, very time consuming. If you've never dealt with these cell phone records, they are incredibly cumbersome. So, you know, the point being here that the state essentially deceived my client's defense team. They chose to do it this way as an ambush. And the trial court's findings related to that are entitled to great deference. Unless this court is going to say that the trial court abused its discretion, something that the state specifically disavowed
in their brief. To Judge Perkins' point, we're just looking at that sliver of one factor in pool.
Yeah, absolutely. But the trial court's findings go to that specific sliver. And the trial court's findings that it was done in bad faith, that it was deliberate, it was not merely a mistake, those go specifically to that second factor. And the state's not challenging those findings.
Did the court impose any sanction for what the prosecutor did here?
The mistrial, that's it. And that's what's equally disturbing
here. Is that a sanction?
No, that's a benefit to the state. And that's what's equally disturbing here is that my client the state got a benefit from its behavior because it got to use that same evidence at the second trial. The very same evidence that its misconduct garnered its opportunity to use. That cuts against both Rule 15.7 and Rule 15.8. My client certainly should have had the opportunity to reconsider any plea offer. Obviously, the court can't force the state to reoffer it, but the court can, if the state says, I'm not going to offer it, imposes a sanction, this evidence
isn't that only the case for a plea offer that had been open at the time of the violation. So, like, here it would have had to be a plea offer open in that final week before the first trial?
I don't agree with that interpretation. The reason I don't is because think of the purpose of Rule 15.8. The purpose of Rule 15.8 is to ensure that a defendant is apprised of the evidence against him when he's making a decision about whether or not to accept a plea offer. Here you have this really important piece of evidence that's been kept from him that he's not aware of.
But that nobody was aware of.
Well, I mean...
until that point in time. Like, that's my
that's
timing
correct.
Issue.
But the easy remedy for that is the state can say, okay, we have this evidence now. Hey, we're going to give you an opportunity to accept the plea again. Now, the state doesn't have to do that, but if they don't, then they don't get to use that late evidence. Otherwise, there's an incentive for the state to hold back evidence and behave exactly as it did in this particular case.
Does anything preclude a defendant from asking the state to re-engage in plea negotiations in light of the evidence?
Certainly not.
Did the defendant do that here?
No. No, but the question here isn't whether he did it. The question is whether the state had an obligation to do it, and for that matter, the court. Now, the court's obligation may be somewhat limited because, again, you have separation of powers concerns that accrue related to that. But in this instance, once the state suddenly discovered this new evidence, which it's free to do, it has a certain path that it has to follow. The proper path is, okay, either it's too late and we have to just go to trial without the evidence, or, hey, we should extend an olive branch to the other side and see if he wants to accept the plea after all in light of this new evidence. So there are ways that the state could have handled this properly. They didn't. They chose a different path. And the path that they chose violated multiple ethical rules, as the court found, not as the defendant alleged, but as the court actually found, it involved bad faith. And the prosecutor in this case still would not accept that she did something wrong. So this isn't a case where she said, oh, I'm sorry, you know, my bad, I apologize for my behavior. She continued to insist that she did nothing wrong. And that's very, very concerning. You know, overall, the body of facts here support that the second factor of pull has been met and that dismissal would have been appropriate. And I do see I have 3 minutes left that I'd like to reserve for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Grace Cynthia Claw. I'm here on behalf of the state of Arizona. This court should affirm Johann's convictions and sentences because none of the claims he presented constitutes reversible error. And I'll just begin where we left off unless the court has a preference. There was no need to apply double jeopardy here because contrary to what Johann argues, you cannot infer that the improper purpose prong of the second prong of Poole from the bad faith finding alone. There are two separate requirements. And here, the trial court, and we agree that the trial court's findings are entitled to deference. And one of those findings is that the severity of the prosecutor's conduct, while bad faith and intentionally done, did not rise to the level to warrant a dismissal of the charges. And that is entitled to deference. And for that reason, he fails at the second prong. And then also that finding is entitled to deference because it is reasonable. It was only a single violation. There was no other evidence of a pattern of misconduct. While Johann alleged multiple times that the prosecutor had engaged in misconduct and other improper behavior, none of those allegations were substantiated, and the trial court rejected most of them. And on appeal, Johann does not contest those rulings.
So what was the proper purpose for trying to introduce this evidence in light of the court's other findings about bad faith?
What was the proper purpose for that it was probative? I wouldn't say significantly probative, but it was probative, and the state was entitled to offer probative evidence as long as it was admissible under the rules of evidence. In addition to that, there is, contrary to what Johann argues, There is no foreseeable strategic benefit that the prosecutor would have obtained here. If the prosecutor, at the time she discovered this information, which is about 10 days prior to trial, if she had disclosed it at that time, we would be in the same situation that they ended up in with the mistrial, in that the court allowed Johan the opportunity to review the newly disclosed information and an opportunity to prepare a response to it. So regardless of which way you look at it, if the prosecutor had disclosed when she first learned about it, likely outcome would have been a continuance with time to prepare a response to that information. Same outcome
isn't
here.
Is the issue that she didn't disclose it?
It is, but I guess my point is that regardless.
So I think the question is there some benefit from not disclosing it and yet still bringing it up at trial? And I think there is. The benefit is either I get it in and the court lets me do it and they haven't had adequate time to prepare for it, or the court doesn't like it, declares a mistrial, and I'll get it in the second time around.
I mean, that's arguably a benefit, but I don't think that there's evidence here in this record to support that that was why the prosecutor did it. We have her explanations that, again, we concede it was probably...
She's not going to admit that's why she did it. How do they get the evidence of an improper purpose like I'm talking about?
You
ask
look at
for
the...
a hearing and put the prosecutor up on the stand and cross-examine her?
No, the court has to look at several factors, and you look at the totality of them. It's an objective standard, but at the same time, the court can look at the prosecutor's explanations and consider them. And I think that's a really important key here, because a part of what that court can do that this court cannot, is assess the prosecutor's credibility. And I think that's an important component of the court's factual finding, that the severity of her conduct did not warrant dismissal.
Am I understanding the point you were trying to make is it makes no difference whether the prosecutor disclosed this information when she learned about it 10 days prior to trial versus first introducing it or bringing it to light at trial?
No, I'm just saying from her disclosing it in opening statements versus had she disclosed it when she had discovered it, the outcome would have likely been the same, because in the instance of disclosure at the time she discovered it, the likely result would have been a continuance that allowed Johan the time to review that evidence and to prepare a response to it, which is the same outcome here where a mistrial was declared and Johan was given the time to review and to prepare a response to this new evidence.
How do we know that, though? Couldn't the court have said you can't disclose things 10 days before trial, and so I'm not allowing it in or continuing the trial?
Well, the court has broad discretion what option
right.
to go with. However, I
doesn't he have
arguably,
speedy trial rights that might come into play if
he did, but he didn't assert them. His only argument below for any sort of prejudice focused on unfair surprise. And here, the remedy that the trial court chose, which was a mistrial.
Well, he didn't assert them because the state didn't disclose the evidence 10 days in advance, which then would have allowed the parties to decide how best to move forward, having that disclosure been made.
But Johan also had the opportunity to, he filed a motion. And he filed a motion and asked for dismissal and double jeopardy to attach. At that time, he could have argued that a mistrial alone wasn't sufficient and the court should dismiss, but he didn't. He focused on unfair surprise.
Did the court impose any sanction at all here?
Aside from the mistrial, no.
I'm not sure the mistrial is a sanction.
But even the proposed sanction, additional sanction, was preclusion. But arguably that wouldn't be appropriate here, because when you really think about it, preclusion would have meant something along the lines of Johan can still argue there was no evidence on his phone, and the state would be prohibited from rebutting that with the truth. To me, that just doesn't seem like an appropriate use of the court's time, and I don't see how you can say that would be a fair verdict.
Can you speak to our discussion with Mr. Opfel about harmlessness in terms of the introduction of this evidence? He seemed to argue that it was critical in terms of the overall evidence that was presented.
And just to add to that, how do you square the fact that I think you concede that the state violated the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights by getting into his phone when it did, right? I know you don't expressly do it, but you don't argue otherwise, which to me is a concession.
We don't argue it, but we assume that it was for purposes of responding.
Okay. So you arguably violated his constitutional rights to get this evidence, and then the prosecutor causes a mistrial by using it, which in my mind means it's pretty important to the state to be able to use this. How do you square that with your harmlessness argument that Judge Payton is referring to?
Well, first of all, materiality for discovery purposes is not the same as materiality for trial evidence. So if we should not be using the trial court's finding with regard to the prosecutor's conduct in order to determine whether or not the evidence was harmlessness for the suppression issue.
I don't think you're suggesting the state violates someone's constitutional rights and provokes a mistrial over immaterial evidence, right?
No, but I do think that the prosecutor, while mistaken, believed that because this evidence had already been disclosed as part of the extraction report far in advance of trial, and that it was easily locatable within the extraction report, and it was probative to a point in the prosecution that she thought she could use it. And
so, sorry, I keep getting off on those tangents. So how is it harmless?
How is it for which issue, I'm sorry?
For the kick, for that evidence to come in.
So okay.
Say we think it's a constitutional violation, the good faith exception doesn't apply. Why is introducing the kick evidence and the grinder evidence harmless?
Because when you look at how it actually was used at court, it was of minimal probative value. It wasn't essential to the state's case. Despite what Johan argues, the state didn't need it in order to prove that Johan was the person who was chatting with Detective Russo on these conversations online. While the evidence themselves may have helped to infer that he was the person on the other end of the conversations, the evidence such as the fact that he showed up with the stuffed animals driving the same car at the same time at the location described in the chats, that alone, I think, was sufficient to show that he was the person who was communicating with Russo. So the state didn't need the kick remnants in order to prove that Johan was the person on chatting with Russo.
What did the fact that he had not just 9,000 Grindr messages, how did that make it more or less likely that he was guilty of these crimes?
So, first, with regard to that, if the court is going to consider that, it should be reviewed for fundamental error because he did not assert a challenge other than relevance. But if we're talking about relevance, again, it's very similar to what the kick, the minimal probative value that it had was that it helped to, again, tie some sort of link to Johan. But again, there was no directly identifying information in either the kick or the grinder evidence. So it was still an inferential step away.
I'm just forgetting the record. Had the officer who was posing as the child's father, did he engage in Grindr messages with Johannes?
If we're talking about Russo, who was the first person, yes, he did on Grindr.
Okay.
So that's where the conversation started.
Okay.
And then it moved to kick. But going to your original question.
What about 9,000? What does that add? I could see now why he had Grindr on his phone. I can see how that is probative. How about the fact there were 9,000 messages? What does that add?
I can't say with certainty because no real explanation was given, but I think a reasonable explanation was that it showed that he was both recently and maybe a frequent user of a Grindr account. It also didn't specify the extraction did not specify that this was the Grindr account that was part of the incriminating conversation. And it also, I believe it was Detective Bodine who described the Grindr evidence that was extracted was not, he couldn't say for sure if it was actually a Grindr app or if it was sort of a third party replica type thing of Grindr that referenced Grindr. And then we will, just a couple of things about what Johan pointed out with regard to this issue. We don't need a binding appellate precedent. All we need to show for good faith is that their officers had an objectively reasonable reliance that their conduct was lawful when they conducted the search.
So what law did the officer rely on objectively here?
They did not have any appellate precedent in the state, and that's probably why they looked to, or that is why they look to federal practice.
Do they have a statute that maybe was ambiguous?
No, there's no statute defining the term execution. There's no appellate binding precedent defining that. In the absence of that clear guidance in this state, it was objectively reasonable for the officers to look to the federal practice in order to determine whether they thought the warrant had been executed. And according to LaChance's testimony, that is exactly what they thought, that the warrant was executed at the time it was issued, which sounds a little illogical, but it is what the federal practice allows. And based on that reasonable belief, they did not feel that they were constricted by this five-day limitation under the state statute.
So federal courts have said the warrant is executed when the judge signs it?
In cases where the item to be searched has already been lawfully seized.
So yes. Who's doing the executing? The judge?
I don't know. Yeah. Wouldn't say for sure how that works. Okay. But it is upon this, one of the, under the federal rule, one of the ways to execute a warrant is when it says when item has been seized. So the item to be seized has been searched. And so I guess in that regard, it's almost self-executing, it sounds like. But here, that is what the officers did. And for that reason, their belief...
You're not asking us to extend that case law to Arizona, right?
No, we don't need to because, again, we still have the good faith exception. And as well as that, the kick remnants were harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because they had minimal probative value.
But you're saying the officer was objectively reasonable because these federal cases exist?
No, because there is no clear guidance in Arizona that defines what it means to execute a data warrant. And in light of... Because there is no such guidance, they had to look elsewhere, and looking to the federal practice was a reasonable option for them, and that is how they determined the warrant had been executed. And so while we were silent in our brief about whether or not...
So how do we draft a decision, though, that says, okay, nothing in Arizona, they look to this federal case law. Federal case law somehow says that the warrant is executed when the judge signs it. They're reasonable because that exists, and then not have parties later on come to us and say, basically, you endorsed those opinions because you said it was objectively reasonable for the officers to rely on them. That's my fear.
That's your fear. I think if the court wanted to extend it to this federal practice, that wouldn't be wrong. It would actually provide much guidance in the state, I think, to officers. Another option, if the court were to go that route, is they could look to our statutes that the legislature has already created regarding cell site simulator devices and tracking devices. There they carve out a specific definition for what it means to execute a warrant in those instances. And those are a little bit more practical when it comes to data warrants. So in those instances, a warrant is deemed executed once the examination has been initiated, and that would be a little more practical here. So if the court wanted to go the route of defining for law enforcement what it means to execute a warrant in this type of circumstance, we could either follow the federal practice or we could look to our own statutes. And I believe it's 13-4294. Yeah. And...
Or we could say there's some value in putting officers on notice that they shouldn't do this in the future, and therefore the exclusionary rule applies.
You could. I think, though, respectfully, that would be disregarding the practical realities of trying to execute a data warrant in these kind of circumstances. Phones are different than homes. You can go to a door of a home or a car, and you can easily, it's within the officer's control to open it and to execute that search. A phone, on the other hand, is completely different. You have encryptions, passwords, booby traps, and sometimes, at least with a password, it's not always within an officer's control to extract that information on site. They have to sometimes either ship it out if their own facility doesn't have the forensic tools available to do that. Or even in this instance, we see that even when the officers have those tools, they don't have the software yet to accommodate newer models and newer versions of hardware and a phone.
But if that's the case and there's an existing question about what that term means, wouldn't you just file an extension?
Yes, that's also a reasonable option. We're just saying that if this court were to say that a warrant here, to execute a warrant in a data warrant situation, if it had to be done within 5 days, that would just be creating a big hardship for law enforcement to try to meet that deadline. They could obtain another warrant, but it would also rely on the same information. And that also goes to the staleness issue of this type of circumstance.
And that's actually what I meant to, obtaining a new warrant. Because I think, does the rule provide for one extension is permitted?
Yes, and only for 5 days.
So then that would be the option.
And also, though, with this particular type of data warrant or with electronic devices, the purpose of enforcing a temporal restriction, such as what our state statute does for execution, it does so on the premise that staleness, the probable cause will go stale because of changeable circumstances. We do not have that here generally with cell phones, because cell phones and other electronic devices can be preserved, it's secure, the data can be preserved. And here those precautions were taken. The phone was placed on airplane mode, the SIM card was removed, it was placed in an evidence locker and eventually placed in a secured forensics lab and plugged in.
Yeah, but so can a home, right? They post an officer in the driveway and out on the street, prevent anyone from going inside or touching anything. I don't think we'd say that if the police do that, then it's okay for them not to execute the warrant in 5 days.
Well, we're not saying that that's always the case, but that is the rationale behind imposing these restrictions, is this fear that probable cause will go stale, and to ensure that there is no staleness issue, legislature has imposed this requirement, and the federal law does so as well. But I think this, again, the data warrant context is unique in that we don't have a staleness issue. Here we didn't have a staleness issue. It was the same circumstances. The crimes had already been committed before Johan was even arrested. At that point, all they needed to do was to tie Johan to this crime, to these crimes. And the evidence that was on his phone, because the officers took the proper precautions, the probable cause that the phone would contain evidence of these crimes was still in full force and effect by the time the search actually occurred. And that also goes to why the officers acted reasonably, because when they conducted the search, they still had probable cause based on the same circumstances asserted in the search warrant. And they did what they could to extract the information within a reasonable amount of time, and the only delay was due to technological impossibility. Just like to make one more point, Okay. Then the state asked the court to affirm, and we rest on our brief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I don't recall there being any provision in the Fourth Amendment that says that if it's really hard to get into something, then you can get extra time.
Yeah, that might be the point of the Fourth Amendment in some cases, right?
Precisely. I mean, the point is to protect. And when you look at Riley is pretty absolute, and you need a warrant to get into this. And once the warrant's void, they don't have a warrant, that's it. And so talking about the notion of whether or not there's harmlessness, the state emphasized this evidence throughout the entire trial. Going back to my opening brief and my reply brief, I string cited all the times that they referenced this. It's over and over and over again. And frankly, even the state in its answering brief admitted that this was noteworthy evidence. So I just don't think that you can get to harmlessness. I do think that you have to show binding appellate precedent, and that's under Weakland, Habitone, federally Davis. So that's pretty well-tread law there. On the pool issue, this is not an inference that's being made. This is a finding that was made by the trial court. Trial court found bad faith. Trial court found it was deliberate. There's no inferences that need to be made here. We have the trial court's findings. This is also not a single isolated issue. The state discussed the credibility of the prosecutor. There was at least one prior instance where the prosecutor admitted that she knew that the detective was not forthcoming with the court about evidence related to Calio because of the existence of a non-disclosure agreement. Now, we're not litigating the Calio issue because we don't think there was error in the lack of discovery there. However, it illustrates that this was an ongoing problem. This was an issue with this prosecutor not being forthcoming with the court. When you have a detective that's saying something that the prosecutor knows is not true, the prosecutor needs to bring that to the attention of the court. So this was not an isolated incident. Obviously, there was a foreseeable benefit to the state. They got to use the evidence. Discussing what the likely outcome would have been had the prosecutor raised it beforehand, the likely outcome would have been that the court probably would have said, well, you discovered it too late. We're going to trial. The court was not interested in further continuances. And if the court had said otherwise, then precisely as Johannes did in his request, in his motion to dismiss, the defense could have gotten up and cited him and Esvi Chavez and said, look, you're forcing us to choose between speedy trial rights and our right to discovery and effective assistance of counsel. You can't do that. So this likely outcome that it just would have been, okay, no harm, no foul, here's your continuance, go ahead and use it in the second trial, I don't believe that that's a realistic outcome. So finally, on the 9,911 messages, this is decided case law. Coghill is really clear on this. You can discuss that my client had access to and had used Grindr in the past because that is probative. There is zero probative value or zero relevance to the number of messages that was only meant to inflame the passions of the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thank you both for your helpful argument and briefing in the case. We will take the matter under advisement and get you a ruling in due course.